Well, Zilla, it's been a hell of a year. Can we start by talking about the kind of industry, the media and tech industry, and what you feel have been the biggest changes this year?
Yeah, it has been a very interesting year, Colin, and I hope we don't repeat it in the way we have in the last 12 months. Yeah, I think there's been lots of talk about an acceleration of media and an acceleration of change over the last 12 months. I think, well, we've seen that acceleration. I do wonder if actually we won't now see post-pandemic, if dare one say those words, a kind of deceleration or a further change to happen. And I think that what happens over the next 18 months, I think, will be as interesting, if not more so, than the changes we saw over the last 18. But I think clearly the one thing I'd call out is that businesses that were well diversified and that were able to lean into where the customer was at that moment in time have been those that have survived the best or performed the best, and clearly technology underpins that. You know, the retailers that didn't have an online presence struggled during the pandemic, and likewise in the media environment, media businesses that didn't have multiple routes to find their customers and to reach their audiences have struggled harder, whereas businesses like our own have performed very well and consistently through the period due to the diversification of the media formats.
Yeah, I mean, that acceleration of digital, which you're referring to, has that demonstrated that consumers have become more versatile themselves and more flexible, or is it just a supply side thing?
You know, it's a really good question, and the honest answer is I'm not sure. You know, before I started my career in books 25 years ago, and the death of books was lauded then, and yet still I find myself putting books in my suitcase when I go on holiday. And so I do think that, well, there is definitely an acceleration of mixed media and definitely more online, I still think people like traditional forms of media as well. And I think that's why we still see people enjoying the radio and TV, and then why we also see such a high enjoyment rate on magazines. And I also think that we mustn't underestimate the environment people were in the last 18 months. I don't know that habits will have changed just as much as people think they have.
Okay, and taking that sort of view of the year, what are the most important changes that Future's seen during that period? If you like, permanent change rather than the whimsical COVID.
So anyone who knows me at all well will know that I don't ever like to say anything is permanent, because life catches you out and you get quoted on it years later. However, I do think that we have seen a change in how people want to work. And that has felt really material in terms of having had this prolonged period of working from home, that we've all had to rethink about how we want to collaborate and how we want to be a workforce together going forward. And I certainly don't see that changing in the short term. And that has a corresponding impact on how we bring our product to the market and how we address our audiences and our consumers. And so I think that's probably the biggest single permanent change for Future as an organisation. I think within media, without any doubt, we've seen this kind of further adoption of online. There's no doubt about it from that perspective. But I also think people have become much more aware of, dare one say, fake news. There was a lot of poor journalism during the last 18 months, particularly actually around the pandemic itself, and then obviously the social factors that were going on around that, particularly in the US. And I think that people are much more questioning of, you know, what influence is this having on my life? What impact might that have? And therefore the responsibility to have quality in what we publish, and that our audiences expect that as well.
What does that really mean for a publisher though, Zilla? I mean, I take the point about working and the way that your people are working and the kinds of people you might be able to recruit that you might not have been able to before, but does fake news or the need to avoid fake news mean in a working environment in Future?
Yeah, so I think people want to work for companies they feel proud of, and they want to work for people who share their values. And I think that what that means for Future is, you know, we pride ourselves as being a specialist publisher, and we've always said that, you know, expertise is what is the distinguishing factor for us. You know, you can't be expert at everything, but the core proposition at Future is about being expert. And I think increasingly what you've seen over the last 12 or 18 months is that people don't want to be associated with organisations that don't take pride in the content they produce or the message or the impact they have in society. And as we, Future, have become a much bigger publisher and reach a much bigger audience, you know, 1 in 2 people in the UK, 1 in 3 people in the US, we have a moral obligation, I think, to make sure that the content we produce and the audiences we reach understand that what we're saying is fact-checked and accurate, and expert, and where we have an opinion, we're clear this is an opinion as opposed to a statement of fact, and that we highlight that and expose that. And so I really do feel that that's a responsibility we have as media owners to ensure people understand what they're consuming.
There's a need, isn't there, in that? I mean, that's an unarguable point, I think, but there's a need within that to find new language and new ways of demonstrating that to consumers, you know, which ought to be a competitive advantage if you do it well. But you do have to guess a bit as a consumer when you're picking up a magazine or newspaper, don't you? And in time, won't companies like Future both be able to get that right, but also to take advantage of it by almost bringing the audience inside, more membership, stitched together audiences? Is that half an idea?
Yeah, so certainly when we acquired Dennis earlier this year, one of the reasons for that acquisition was to bring in more capability and experience around, you know, management of subscriptions and consumers who want to belong to a brand or identify with a brand or a type of content, and thinking through about how we do that at scale across the wider group. And so I really do think that curated content, expertly written, is certainly a way forward for us. With the emphasis being we would expect the majority of that to be our own content, but with some curation around it. And certainly that's what we do in Smart Brief as well as what we do in Dennis. I mean, essentially that's a Smart Brief, a roundup of what we think is important and the things that matter to you. However, I do think there's a danger around everything being inside an ecosystem that you end up with an echo chamber. And so I do really support the wide distribution of content, and that's why our strategy has been to be channel agnostic, because I really do think that the debate and the ability to choose what you want to read is also really important. And if we're not careful, we go to the app we always go to, and then we just believe what we're reading is everyone's perspective and point of view.
Well, I mean, the highlights for an observer of Future last year are that you did three very large deals, presumably your three largest ever deals. What did you learn from doing those deals, perhaps one by one?
Yeah, sure. And certainly they were a highlight for us in doing them in the pandemic, because they were all undertaken during the pandemic, has been interesting. But I think the highlight for us has actually been how brilliant the business has been underlying that during this last 12 months as well. And so it's only been because of that really brilliant core foundation that we've been able to look to do these acquisitions. But if we take them individually, so the first deal we announced was TI Media, which we announced in the November before the pandemic, and then the deal actually closed about a week after we went into UK-wide lockdown. And I think that probably the singular biggest thing that I learned from that transaction is the quality of the asset you buy is really important, because when things happen that you can't predict, good brands, good content, a long-term strategy for what you're trying to achieve will prevail. I'm not going to pretend buying 40-odd magazines as the shops closed didn't feel short-term like the best thing I'd ever done. However, I was completely confident this was the right deal for us longer-term, and the strategic rationale around the opportunity to take that content to the US was really clear for us. And so I was reassured and comforted by the fact that the reason we bought the business wasn't because of the newsstand sales in the UK, but was about the strategic opportunity. I think then, on the second acquisition, which was the GoCo acquisition, which we then announced, November of that year, closed in February of this year. What was the biggest learning I had there? Maybe we need to be more explicit about the things we think everyone understands about our business. When you sit inside your business, you think everyone understands your strategy and what you're trying to achieve. And we thought that everyone would understand and get why we wanted to buy a price comparison site. As you'll know, the share price reaction of the day was quite to the opposite of that. And so we obviously took the market by surprise. And so that really made me think about how we communicate, and are we clear enough and articulate enough about what being at Future means and what we're trying to achieve. And then the most recent acquisition, which was Dennis Publishing, which we completed in September, I think, of this year. We're still quite early into that, but again, I think the thing that I have been reminded of is the real value of content and, you know, talented individuals and expertise within that. However, there is one overarching about all three, which I just want to pick up on, because it happens in every acquisition, and you can't ever underestimate it, which is acquisitions are about people, and we're in a people business. And so every acquisition is individual, because you acquire a collection of individuals, and so never getting to the point when you think that you know exactly how this is going to go is really important, because each organization needs to have some reverence to its culture, but also recognizing where we want to go. So we need to stay firm in direction, but respectful of what we've acquired.
Is it, I mean, two of those businesses are basically magazine businesses. And is one of the other observations one could make that you've realized that on the one hand, print magazines are frequently being oversold, and on the other, subscriptions have not yet reached their true valuation because the annuity base of subscriptions is so powerful?
Yeah, so again, I'm long on the record of being a massive fan of magazines. We at Future see huge value in that as a category. We think that the journalism that goes on there, the product that's produced is fantastic. I think that lots of people dismiss magazines as a category, thinking that the structural decline means that you're buying something that has no value, whereas our view on this is that you've got wonderful IP in the content that you get. You've often got fantastic brands, which are long remembered by people long after they stop buying the magazine on the newsstand. I think the biggest challenge for the magazine industry has been distribution. And actually, it's been the pressure on retailers, I think, that's caused as much of the distribution challenge for magazines as actually the consumer choice, which is why subscriptions are so important. And good quality magazines that meet the audience's needs in our portfolio will have retention rates north of 70%. You know, and the older or the longer someone has subscribed, the more sticky they get. And therefore, I think there is a real annuity in the portfolio that people do not understand.
And when you make these huge deals, I suspect that the analysts, when they gulp a bit, not just on Go Compare, sometimes think to themselves, oh my God, you know, I wish they'd carry on and develop their, look after the business they've got. And it's that, how easy is it to protect your current business when you're doing something as big as that? Because those three acquisitions are clearly much bigger than the pre-existing business. How do you do that?
Yeah, and so I think the idea about size is a real relative measure, because what is the size of a large acquisition? Is it the number of brands? Is it the money you pay for it? Is it the number of people you acquire? And so I sometimes say to the analysts and the shareholders, don't think that the financial price paid equals the complexity of the acquisition. And so we look at each acquisition in consideration of how complex will this be to integrate, how much change. And so I think when you take a step back, probably the TI acquisition was the most complex, but of the three, the least value in terms of the price we paid for it, because it had over 40 brands. There was a lot more people involved. It was over 1,000 people in the organization. And so that was much more time consuming and considerate in terms of, you know, what the impact in the organization than buying Go Compare, which was largely three brands. So in terms of the change to the business, much more minimal and the disruption, yet that was the most expensive acquisition to date that we've undertaken. But I think the key point is that you've got to have people who work with you who have a willingness to want to do this too. So now again, alignment to vision and alignment to the objective. And we spend a lot of time at Future talking about, you know, one future, and we do the right thing for Future rather than necessarily the right thing for our brands or the right thing individually for our functions and what we're trying to achieve. And I was just chatting earlier today with our CFO, we're talking about, I don't really think much past 24 months, because who knows? And again, that's what the last 12 months have taught us. But over the next 48 months, are we really, or 24 months, are we really clear about what we want to achieve? Are we really clear about where we're going? And is everyone around you aligned behind that? And then you've got permission. You've got permission to go and buy businesses like that from the organisation. And I think that's really important. And I think probably if there's one thing that you can't do, but I feel a huge thanks to the organisation for letting us do these acquisitions, because most people in the business don't get to be involved in that conversation. But many of them have to deal with the consequences of it. And so I think we should always remember that it's the colleagues that actually, you know, add the production, buy the additional paper, and the downstream impacts of these changes.
But you must have encountered enough problems. There must be people who think they're overworked as it is, and you've just given them some more work, or you've squeezed their desk up against a wall, or you've moved them somewhere, or you've made them, persuaded them to do something that they weren't doing before. Aren't there real problems in any substantial deal like that?
Yeah, so I've never met anyone that thought that they were underworked or underpaid. So I always think that that's a kind of opening position. But having said that, I think that every acquisition brings its own unique issues. And you don't know what's going on behind the scenes in that business before you buy it, because people, you know, dress businesses for sale. And every acquisition has elements which are much easier than you think, and equally much harder in terms of things that you don't expect to happen. So, for example, with GoCompare, how could we have possibly foreseen the energy crisis we're in just now? And, you know, it's fortunate that the part of the business we attributed the least value to, which was the LAM, the look after my bills part of the business, is the bit that's been impacted by the energy, because that wasn't the rationale for why we wanted to do the deal. But if we had been buying it because of that, this would be a difficult situation to be in just now. So I think that's also why we really try hard to have more than one play with every acquisition that we're looking at, so that when the unexpected happens, as it does, like I said, you know, with TI and the shops closing, you aren't kind of suddenly back against the wall from that perspective. Now, because you keep the optionality with the business strategy, it does mean that with people then it's easier, because if you've only got one bet, then if things go wrong, then the knock-on impact on the organisation is more material, because you do have to take actions which you might not want to take. And so that's one of the reasons why we've kind of tried to always have a few bets in play at any point in time from that perspective. But that we're not going to be for everyone. I was reading an article this morning. There's a blog I subscribe to, and the whole point around the fact that, you know, organisations can't be generic places, you know, otherwise we lose the essence of what makes us who we are. And therefore, you know, we do want people who want to work here, who want to be part of our story, who will give us permission, who do know that means that sometimes it will be busier than other times, and it's probably never quiet. And it's okay if that's not what some people want, because at different points in our life, we want different things. There was a point in my life when, you know, I had lots of young children where maybe I wanted to think things a little bit closer. I didn't want to travel. When I joined AutoTrader, I wanted to be in a job that was based in the UK. So I think it's about personal choice. And I think what's really important is people recognise they've got that choice. No one needs to be here. But that we're really clear about what matters to us and where we're trying to go. But we should say no one's being squeezed up against offices, because we're about to go to a really nice new office around the corner. And unlike lots of businesses just now, post-pandemic, she says in brackets, we're really investing in our portfolio of property, because we do think that coming to work in a nice place really matters.
So it's got an atrium, has it?